Hi everybody, and welcome once more to Spotlight, and I'm sure you all know now that Spotlight is the program where we find out about our For the People members. And as always, before I introduce the guest to you, I'd like to thank Becky for all her sterling work behind the scenes, arranging the interviews and making sure that everything runs smoothly, and to Dennis for recording them for archive purposes. Today, I'd like to introduce you to someone who I've known for about 25, 26 years. He's a personal friend of Sue and myself, and it's a great pleasure to introduce him to you. He's a relatively newcomer to For the People. He's only been coming onto the site for maybe 4 or 5 weeks now, maybe a little bit longer. So may I introduce to you Bill Cox. Bill, thanks for agreeing to be interviewed, and can I start by asking you to tell us where and when you were born, if you wouldn't mind?
Thank you, Steve. No, not at all. I was born in the East End of London in 1923, so I'm getting close to being an octogenarian. I first saw the light of day on the 28th of August, 1923, but perhaps I should say that this was considered by the experts, because up until 11 months, apparently, I could see as good as anybody else, but then things started to happen, and, well, it was really a great tragedy for my parents, but... As I say, they didn't know what called in later life, of course, once the sight disappeared. I still get quite a bit of pain from time to time and can cope with it, but that's how it all started.
Okay, Bill, you're just breaking up a little bit there, but we got the gist of it. Can you tell us a little bit about your parents? What did your mum and dad do?
Well, they first noticed that I couldn't see round about the age of 11 months or one year, that they, my mother was telling me that she had a sort of toy in her hand and she was waving it about in front of me, and she noticed that I didn't follow her hand, and she became very concerned, and after a period of time she thought, or both my mum and dad thought, something ought to be done about it, and then started a long series of excursions, first of all to the doctors, and then the doctor recommended me to the local hospital. Apparently the local hospital said they couldn't deal with that, and Moorfields said the case was hopeless. Must have been a dreadful shock for my parents, all this. They also took me to various spiritual healing sanctuaries, but unfortunately things didn't get better. And finally, they heard of an Austrian specialist called Gruber, and they took me to see him. And he charged a guinea for the interview, which was a lot of money in those days, in about 24, 25, and no, it was later than that, probably 26, because they'd had 2 or 3 years of all this, and he eventually said that the optic nerve had completely disintegrated, and that whatever sight I had probably wouldn't last the rest of my life, and I certainly wouldn't be able to, when I grew up, he said I certainly wouldn't be able to earn a living in the normal way. And of course, I mean, I don't remember all this. I just can't remember any of it, really. That my first real recollections of being different was when I went to a boarding school.
So it was obviously a traumatic shock for your parents, and they did their very, very best to help you to regain your sight, which unfortunately, as we know, didn't work. Would you say that you had a pretty ordinary childhood. Were you restricted in what your parents allowed you to do pre-school, or were they very protective towards you?
Oh no, they weren't. This was the best part about it, really. They treated me, or tried to treat me, as anybody with normal sight. Apparently, I was a terror when I was a youngster. One or two things I can tell you which I did. I used to throw knives and forks out of the window, and one day I managed somehow or other to lock my mother in the chicken's run, and I also threw it out of her. In those days, we lived in a house with a cellar. There was a big hole in the woodwork at the side of the cellar, and I was quite a handful, apparently, and I suppose that in a way was a good thing.
A spirited man, and you're still the same now. You're still a little terror on occasion. Oh dear. Okay, so did you have any brothers and sisters, Bill, or were you an only child?
Yeah, I would have had twin brothers. They would have been born in 1924, but unfortunately, shortly after I was born, my mother's mother died, and obviously my grandmother, but my grandfather, or my mother's father, felt that he couldn't live without her, and she came home one day. She'd been out, and she was carrying, of course, and she was pregnant. She came home one day, and she found her father hanging from the banisters, and he was dead. Apparently, she called the police. My dad was at work, but she called the police, and the policeman came and had a heck of a job to get him down. And in fact, the policeman actually was such a big man, the policeman actually broke his back and had to be taken away as well. And of course, my mother collapsed on the doorstep, had a miscarriage, and lost both children, two boys. So I would have had twin brothers.
That's a terribly, terribly sad story, Bill. As I say, I've known you many, many years, but I didn't realise that had actually happened to you. It's very, very sad, and thank you for sharing it with us. Okay, so you were this spirited little boy, mischievous little boy, and eventually I imagine that you ended up in school for the blind. Can you tell us what it was like in a school for the blind? Round about 75 years ago?
Yeah, I went to a school in East London. It wasn't too far away from my home. It started there in January 1929. If I could just go back a little and say that there had been a long discussion as to what would happen to me with regard to education, I'm sorry, my grammar's dreadful, isn't it? With regard to education, and it was decided in the end that I should go to this school for the blind, but they also said that my family, my mother and father, would have to pay a contribution towards my board and lodging there. They said the education probably would be free, but at least they would have to pay so much a week for my board and lodging. At least I think that's how they put it. And they settled on the sum of 4 shillings, and this stayed in being. Well, I think it increased a little up to 1939 when I left the school. And I think it's a bit harsh, really, because after all said and done, my father was only earning somewhere in the region of about £3.05. I expect you people in the States would realise that was, well, in some ways, I suppose it was a lot of money in those days. Well, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was a reasonable wage. But at the same time, you take 4 shillings out of it, and, well, it's just... It just seems so vastly unfair. And as I got to understand the school, I found out that there were plenty of people there whose parents didn't pay anything. They didn't have to. What was it like at school? I don't remember the early stages of it. As I say, I was five. The first thing I can remember is standing by a rocking horse in what was called the nursery. I can recall that, and I can recall waking up one morning, because I could see a little bit in those days, not a lot, but I could still see, and it being very dark, and along to the bathroom to sort of be washed. I can remember that, but Mum and Dad told me, because they both came with me, to the school with me, to leave me there, and apparently I screamed the place down, clinging to my dad and saying, "Don't leave me, Daddy." It must have been heartbreaking for them, really. I don't remember any of it, but this is what happened. And I gradually began to, gradually began to dawn on me that I wasn't at home. I just wasn't at home. I can vaguely remember, before I left home on that day, we had a cabinet gramophone, and my dad put on a record. He said, have a listen to some music before we actually go. I can recall that, but otherwise that first day and those first few weeks seemed a blank to me. And we've got a record, we've got a letter actually, we in our sort of archives here, we've got a letter from the headmistress of the school, who said in the letter that she said that I was settling down okay, and now that I'm beginning to talk and to talk to everybody, I'm quite a bright little lad. Rather a compliment, I suppose. We had three classes at that school. There was a junior class, the second class, and what was called the top class. I stayed in the juniors class until I was 10, around about 10, I think. Then I went into the second class until I was about 13, and then the top class to 16. It was quite interesting in the early stages of the education. I was taught Braille, but I don't remember learning it. This is a strange thing, because Braille to me is everything. I visualise Braille in my mind, as you, some of you would visualise sighted in your minds, but I visualise Braille, but I never remember learning it. How was it at school again? It was all right. It was very difficult at times. You very much had to fend for yourself. People would be kind and help you, but also you would be mimicked and laughed at if they thought that you weren't doing things right. And I think I resorted to tears on many occasions, but as I got older, I learnt to cope with it. And of course, as we got on to when we got on to the later part of the school, this was very, very different. I got interested in girls. My goodness me, if you said hello to a girl at the school I went to, you'd almost be expelled. I must say that I got very friendly with a girl, and one day, well, it was in the middle of the night, we decided to go downstairs and meet. Nothing terrible happened, I can assure you, but we did actually meet downstairs in the schoolroom. Had to creep down very quietly, but had I been caught, of course, I would have been expelled. But it was just a schoolgirl, schoolboy romance. It didn't really come to anything in the end. But I would say that in almost any school for the blind, and when I eventually went to Dalton House after leaving school, it's very much the survival of the fittest. I don't know what it's like now, of course, because I don't get to schools, but very much the survival of the fittest, and sometimes it could be heartbreaking, sometimes it could be very laughable.
Thanks, Bill. That was an excellent description of your school days. And I'm sure that many of us can relate to a lot of things that you said there. We've all had similar experiences. The ones of us who've been away to residential school sure can relate to a lot of what you said there. What were your favourite subjects at school? I know music played a big part in your early life, didn't it? What were your favourite subjects at school?
Undoubtedly history. Music, of course, was very much to the fore. I really wanted to be a musician. I really did. And that was one of the biggest disappointments of my life, that I was stifled in my attempts to become a piano tuner and perhaps a musician as well. History I liked. I've never been good at arithmetic, though strangely enough I can work out things if Beryl sends me out shopping, and that I can work out exactly how much I spent, how much change I should have back, and I come back with it all detailed in my head. I could never do that at school, Steve.
Yeah, okay. I suppose as you were coming towards the end of your time at school, it must have been partway through World War II. Just briefly, it's very apt at the moment as we speak. Can you tell us what it was like living in London as a totally blind person during that period?
Well, actually, I left school in July 1939. The war hadn't started. I had already been to the Royal, it was called in those days the Royal Normal College for the Blind, but I think you know it now as the, well, it is now the Royal National College for the Blind, and I had been there to sit for a Gardener's Trust scholarship. Now, I took this scholarship, and part of it was to show if I could tune a piano note, and also could I make an eye in a string for a piano. That was part of it. There was arithmetic and geography and everything. I gather I passed it, but when I got back to school, because I stayed there for about 3 or 4 days, when I got back to school, the letter came through to the school from West Hanborough Council saying that there was no money to be made in piano tuning, there was no money to be made in music whatsoever, and they would only consider funding me, putting funds for my training if I went on to basket work or something in that nature. Well, then the war broke out. I went back to school from September 1939. I went back to the school because it was due to be evacuated, so I became an evacuee. It's amazing because many of you listening in America won't know the outlay probably of London, but we have just beyond the suburbs we have a place called Hutton. It's within, I suppose, 25 miles of the centre of London, but it was considered to be a safe area. Oh, it's laughable, really, because I left there in 1940 and went to Dalton House, a school for the blind, to be trained as a basket baker. I left there, sorry, in 1939. They didn't want me to go home for Christmas because they said that London was too dangerous. So I wrote to my mum and dad and said I should be getting a train from Shenfield to Liverpool Street. If you don't come and meet me, I shall still get home somewhere. Because that frightened them, so they came down and... Well, at least my dad came down. Of course, a foggy day, I can remember it now. And he came down and he took me back to my home. I had to sign a paper that he would be responsible for me. Well, I mean, it was about the daftest thing under the sun because he was responsible for me anyway. And, of course, he said, I've come down because I believed you and what you said. You would come home. And I certainly would. I mean, two or three of them said they would help me by getting me to the station. So... That would have gone off. Anyway, I got home, and I went away, as I say, in January. It was rather taking a long while to get round to what it was like in the war. But the war came, and it was there. And in 1940, I came home in the summer for a 6 weeks holiday. The first 3 or 4 weeks of it were nice and quiet in London, though the Battle of Britain was in full swing. And then suddenly we began to get air raid warnings. After about the fourth one, because I felt terrified when I heard these air raid signs, nothing seemed to happen. After about the fourth air raid, we had two on the Friday, two on the Sunday. After the fourth one, I didn't feel quite so bad, and I thought, oh, this is all right, don't worry about it, and when the air raids come. But on September the 7th, we never forget it, we had to rush to the shelters. The Germans suddenly broke through over London. There was a rain of bombs everywhere. Oh, dear, oh, dear. And tremendous damage, fires. I could still, I could still see a little then, and I could even see the fires. And then, of course, the Blitz came. I went away in September again to carry on with my training for basket making, but I came home for Christmas, and we had some terrible raids over just after the Christmas period. The gunfire was terrific. I don't think they ever hit much in those days, but I think the gunfire was more of a consolation to us than anything else. But it's tremendous noise, and I always remember we used to go out. Because I was old enough then, I was coming up to 17, so I could go out with my mum and dad to the local. And we used to go out some evenings, and you could rest assured, once we got over the road, out of the house, suddenly the guns would start opening up, and we'd be running along with our heads down for protection. But it wouldn't have made any odds, because if anything had come down, shrapnel or anything, it would hit us. But you do these things subconsciously, you see, if you're sort of frightened, or you think that something's going to happen, you sort of get down, and that's what we did. But no, it was no joke. It was terrible. It really was. I can recall the Blitz, and I can recall the flying bombs. These were kinds of things which the American named them, when we picked the name up, doodlebugs. They came over, there wasn't a pilot in them, and when they got over London, suddenly the engine stopped and it just glided down and crashed. Of course, it landed on the ground. It didn't make a big hole, but by golly, the blast was tremendous. And then after that, they had some other things which were even worse, and I will frankly admit I was terrified of the things. They were what we call V2s, and they came over faster than sound. So you didn't know it was coming, you only heard it when it arrived. A big bang, tremendous bang, and of course they made huge craters, and they killed lots of people, many people. And I remember on one occasion, with one of these V2s, I was working at the West Ham workshops for the blind. I trailed at basket work, and I had to do brush making. That was the next thing they said I got to do, and that meant I had to dip bristles in boiling hot pitch, and then tie them all up and dip them again, and then put them into a broom head and make a broom. Oh dear, you never see the burns I used to get. And fancy making a blind person work like that. It's incredible. You'd be surprised what terrible things that blind people were asked to do in workshops in those days. But as I say, these V2s were coming over at the time, and I used to go home for dinner, and on one day, my mother said to me, I can't do your dinner today. Will you take sandwiches and stay at the workshops? So I said, okay, I'll do that. And he said, just as well as I did, because the bus which I would have taken that dinner time, the trolley bus, as it was passing a pub down the bottom of the road, the rocket landed on the pub, destroyed most of the pub, certainly destroyed the bus, and had I been on it, I would have been killed. So, I'm still here, Chris, still here, Steve.
Yes, and we're very, very pleased you are. Anyway, we've got a lot to go through, we've got a lot to get through, Bill. There's a lot to your life, and we're only just scratching the surface, so we've got to move it on a little bit. You mentioned your slight brush with basket making, and then your brush with brush making. Can you just elaborate a little bit on the brush making process and why it was so awful, and then we'll move on to other things afterwards. Just give us a brief idea what brush making involved.
Certainly, yeah. Once I get going, I'm terrible, aren't I? Yes, the brush making. Well, what happened? You had a bundle of bristles, but on your left hand side, you gathered up enough bristles which you thought would fit into the hole. You then fanned them out, dipped them into the boiling pitch, wiped the bristles on a kind of ledge which stretched across the pitch pan. And then you tied it up, making sure you didn't burn yourself, and then you dipped it again, and you dragged it across the, you had to be quick, you dipped it into the pitch again when it had all been tied up into a bundle, and then rammed it into the hole in the broom. And you had to be very, very careful how you did it. I still don't know how I did it, but I used to splash myself all over with pitch. I mean, the Beryl said that even after I left it, months after I left, she was still getting pitch out of my clothing. But it was a terrible business, and I thought to myself, I can't do this all my life, and I moved on to something else.
Yes, so you mentioned Beryl here. I know very well that Beryl's your wife, who you've been married to for many years now. When did you meet Beryl, and how did it come about?
It came about at a holiday camp after the war. In 1945, I went to a holiday camp in a little place called Angmering, which is near Littlehampton. It's down in the county of Sussex. And I went down there for a week, and then I enjoyed it so much that I asked if I could go back for another week. And the second time I went back, I met several people there. They were very, very nice young girls and lads. They looked after me very well, because obviously by then I couldn't really see much, and they looked after me very well. And on one of the days, it was rather strange, because on one of the days, I still remember it, I can remember it vividly, I heard somebody playing Handel's Largo. And I was walking around the side of the house. I thought, well, I don't know, I'm going to find out who's playing that. So I eventually got into the room, and I said, well, that's nice, that was Handel's Largo. She said, yes, that's right. She said, wasn't very well played, was it? I said, well, it's not too bad. And I said, what's your name? And she said, Beryl Cook. So I said, well, I'm Bill Cox. I think that's what I said. I offered her a cigarette. I offered her a cigarette, Steve. Went to light it, nearly set fire to her hair. And that's how we started.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm learning a lot about you. I've known you all these years, and I'm learning all about you. That's incredible. I never knew that. Well, what a way to start, eh? And you've had a blazing relationship ever since, in the nicest possible way. The nicest possible way. Beryl's a lovely lady. I know Beryl very well. So, you met Beryl, and how long after that did you decide to marry?
I met her after 6 months. We decided to become engaged, and our engagement lasted for 18 months. We married on September the 6th, 1947, so that's some time ago. Incidentally, I'd just like to finish off, if I may, very briefly about the way we met. After we met and the holiday was over, I'd actually invited her, because I was a very keen promenade goer in those days. I don't know how much you know in America, but we have a season of promenade concerts. Usually runs from July to September. And I got tickets for about 30 of these concerts. And I was finding it difficult to get people to go with me. I thought I could go out on the outside of the hall and offer a ticket and find proms. And she said she'd love to. So she came to the proms with me for most of them. And after the last night of the proms, I thought that was all over. And I remember a whole week went by, and I didn't see anything of her. And suddenly on a Saturday night, I was listening to a play on the wireless, and there was a ring at the doorbell, and I went in to answer it. And she was standing on the doorstep there, and she said, there's a fair over the local park. Would you like to, can we go? I'd like to go. Would you come with me? And we never looked back after that. We went on roundabouts and things and, you know, screamed and hollered as everybody else did. And that's how we got going.
That's amazing, Bill. And obviously after that, you decided to marry, and there you have children. We'll probably come on to that in a little while. But can we just go back now to your work career? So you decided that brushmaking wasn't for you, and I don't blame you, it sounds highly dangerous to me, messing around with boiling hot pitch. So what was your next move? What did you do next after the brushmaking?
Well, the next move was to try and become a telephonist. That's what I thought I would like to do. I really wanted to be, I couldn't be a musician, but I would love to have been a social worker, but there didn't seem to be any avenues to be a social worker at that time, so I went to the RNIB, for Royal National Institute for the Blind, for an interview, and they decided that they thought I was suitable to be trained as a telephonist, and I'd only been married a year. I started in September 1948, and I made it quite clear when I got down to, or when I got to Bridgnorth in Shropshire, because that's where the training centre was in those days, I told them that I would be coming home at the weekend, which I mean I was only been married a year, and I just wanted to get home and see my wife. They absolutely opposed it and said I couldn't do it, the work would be so exhausting that I would need a weekend to recover and all the rest of it. Well, I mean, that's a load of nonsense. It wasn't terribly exhausting, it wasn't easy work, but it wasn't exhausting. I mean, I was all right at the end of the week, and I just told them I was going home, and they said, well, providing you're back by Sunday night, we can't stop you. And of course they couldn't stop me, and so that's what happened. And I was there for about 8 weeks. I was supposed to be there for 12, but I managed to get through the course. This is no boast or anything, I just managed to get through the course in 8 weeks. You see, I knew Braille, and Braille was one of the most important parts of it, as well as answering telephones and calls and how to handle calls, but Braille was very important. And after 8 weeks, I went up on their switchboard, finishing off the course, and then I was fortunate enough to get a job with what was then called the Ministry of Labour. That was in 1953. I stayed there till 1958. In 1957, I transferred from the East End of London. I was working at an office in the East End of London, and I transferred to an office in Norwich. I managed to convince the Norwich authorities that I was working ahead of a job, and I needed housing accommodation. And that was really our first home, really. We were there. Up to that time, we'd been living in a flat upstairs with my parents, but the Norwich Corporation, after a lot of argument and refusing and all the rest of it, they eventually said that I could have a house. And I stayed in Norwich until for a couple of years, very, very happy years, worked at the Ministry of Labour. But unfortunately, I got some ear trouble. It was noise. It was a nuisance, and it was very painful. And I went to the doctor and told him about it. He said, "Well, I can probably help you to get rid of it, but it would be better if it's possible for you to do something else rather than wear headphones and things all day long." So I approached the Southern Regional Association for the Blind. They were an organisation who trained what was called in those days Home Teachers of the Blind. To my amazement, I got an interview. And I passed it. I never forget it. It was a committee of about 20 people, and they were all filing questions. But I got through that, and I did a year's course with them, and I qualified. I was told that it sounds terribly boastful, this, Steve, but it's just true. I was told that I mustn't expect any distinctions or honours. I would be lucky to pass the actual main examination. And of course, when the results came through, I got 2 distinctions, 4 credits and a pass. I was rather pleased about that, for 2 reasons. One, that I'd done better than they said I would, and the second one, I just felt so pleased, and so did the rest of my family.
I'm not at all surprised, Bill. I'm not at all surprised. You're a remarkable guy. Did this mean then that now you were qualified as a social worker for the blind? Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely, yes. My first job was with the Lincoln Corporation. I got that we were told, we were asked that when we were on the calls, if adverts came up to answer them, and if we got an interview, we would be allowed to go and do it, do the interview, have the interview. And I went to Lincoln for an interview. There were six candidates there, and I got it. Couldn't believe it. Went back, and they were absolutely delighted, but still they said, you know, you'll be lucky to pass, but I'm glad you got a job, because they said they would wait for me. I spent about 9 months with Lincoln. I realised it wasn't... You've got to get a footing in somewhere when you're qualified. I realised it wasn't quite the job for me, but events took almost a bizarre turn in the lifetime, because my parents became rather ill, both of them, particularly my father, and I wanted to try to get a post near to them. Now, he had bought a house in a place called Leyndon, which is about, I suppose, 20 miles out from London, on the way to Southend-on-Sea, and he couldn't keep going there because he wasn't well enough, and my mother didn't like it down there. She was very much an East Ender, and she was far happier in West Ham. So I asked them if I could get a job with Essex County Council, and they advertised for a job, and if I could get the job, could I take over the house? And they said that they thought that would be a good idea. So I applied to Essex County Council. I was called in for an interview. There were six people again. I seem to have always had six, and I should never forget that, because that was quite a good, it was quite a reasonable sort of interview. I was absolutely terrified, because to me it was all or make it, all or nothing. If I didn't get that, I didn't really want to go back to Lincolnshire, because I didn't like the setup. Anyway. I should never forget it. I'd been in for the interview. Everybody had been. We were all sitting around, the six of us, and suddenly one of the interviewees, the people who were interviewing, came out. He stood there, and I thought to myself, come on, say something, say something. And he said, Mr. Cox, would you come through? God, I couldn't believe it. Anyway, I went through, and I was offered the job. And I explained that I got some accommodation to go to, because that's the first thing they asked me, and I said, yes, I've got some accommodation. I got the job, and I spent some very happy years. I had a caseload of about 250. It was hard work. I did several areas all round the outskirts of London in Essex, and we used to run handicraft classes. I had to organise outings. I had to go on outings. I travelled a lot on buses and trains, and it was very, very nice indeed. And I stayed with Essex for a number of years, and eventually I got a job in the London Borough. I thought I would like to work in London just to see what it was like, and I got a job in London Borough of Barking and Dagenham, which was very interesting. Again, huge caseload, lots of traffic. Oh dear. And eventually I went back again. I left London and came back to Essex County Council and took a job in Basildon. Now I must tell you this, that I could have done none of it at all, but for the guide dogs for the Blind Association. I'd had a guide dog since 1958. My first dog went with me on the training course. He went everywhere with me, and over the years, I've had all of them. It's remarkable, you know. 250, in most instances, I had 250 people to visit, and the dog learned all the places. And I could stop at gates. He would stop at gates where he knew people, he or she, whichever it was, the dog I had, knew where people were living, and it was absolutely remarkable. And of course, if I wanted to go on trains and that, there was no as indeed today. I mean, with a guide dog, you're absolutely independent. And I owe a great debt of gratitude to the guide dogs for the blind, for the seven dogs which I've had. There was one of them still laying down on the floor right by me here at the moment. I don't know whether he's listening. I hope he isn't. He wouldn't believe a word of it. But there you are. It's been wonderful, Steve, and that's what helped me to be a social worker. But I eventually I'm afraid I did become disillusioned, as you know, I'm sure you know. Social work for the blind took a back seat in the 70s. They were far more interested in producing what they called a generic social worker, somebody who could cope with everything, which is impossible. And blind people were left at the bottom of the pile, and I got so fed up with it that I decided to do something else, and I left it, and I was on the what we call the dole for a while, and then I thought of the National Tape Magazine for the Blind, and we started that, and eventually we also, Beryl and I, we started a library for the blind. We used to send out cassettes every week to people, and then you came along, you and Sue, because I'd heard Sue, and I wanted somebody who I thought could really be a good compere for a magazine. Somebody could introduce the items, and I suggested to you that Sue could do it. I'm jolly glad you agreed she could, because she did it for many, many years, and she was absolutely wonderful. I mean, she got a nationwide reputation over doing that, and I'm eternally grateful to you both for that.
It was our pleasure, Bill, and it's a great pleasure to be involved. Can you just tell the people listening a little bit about the magazine? What sort of a vision did you have for it? What did you hope it would achieve? And tell them the sort of things you used to produce, the sort of things we used to do way back when.
Yeah, my idea for the magazine was that it should do several things. First of all, I hoped it would get blind people, if they agreed to subscribe to it, to get to know each other. And also, I envisaged that we should put items on which would be helpful to people if they'd lost their sight. We used to discuss all kinds of apparatus for... We did features for all kinds of apparatus on the magazine for blind people, and we used to interview social workers and various organisations who were working for the blind. I wanted to bring all this to blind people, but I also wanted them to realise that, I mean, although it's a dreadful thing to lose your sight, and you just try somehow to cope with it. And if the magazine could give encouragement to blind people, and could I give encouragement to them, because I hope that they realised in the end that I couldn't see, and could I give them encouragement and help them, and you and Sue gave them encouragement, then I think we were halfway there, or more than halfway. And that was the general idea. We used to have funny things as well. Oh, you'd be surprised, Steve, didn't we? Well, you wouldn't be surprised because you were in it, but we used to go to... We actually did an interview inside a prison. Oh, dear. Inside a swimming bath at one occasion, I seem to recall, not so much a swimming bath, in a hospital where they were doing physiotherapy, and they tried to get me to go into a pool to see how it was all done. Oh, it's amazing. We did so many different interviews. We went to big department stores, places like Selfridges and Gamages, and I went out with the police on a launch on the River Thames, and I went in a helicopter and did... I was terrified when I got in that helicopter, and suddenly the recorder started playing up, and I had to work, and by the time I got the recorder to work, I had to do an interview with the pilot while he was actually flying the thing, and I didn't have time to be nervous in the end, but that was my first and only occasion of actually going up into the air. But it was a good life. It was a good life. And of course, I sent you to places. I mean, you did quite a bit, didn't you, for the magazine? You went to several places, and you did quite a lot of interviews in your own home, didn't you?
Yes, indeed, we did. Yeah, that's perfectly true. And can you just also tell the listeners about the tremendous struggle you had to actually get the magazine off the ground. I mean, it was no mean feat, was it? You were fighting against all sorts of problems. You'd moved house by then, I know. You'd gone to live in Lincolnshire. But I know you did have terrible, terrible problems actually setting the magazine up, you know, in a physical sense, let alone a... what's the word I'm looking for? I'm searching for... No matter the ethical sense or what you wanted it to be, but the actual major difficulties you had to overcome to actually get the equipment and to get a studio.
Oh, indeed, yes, yes. That was one of the hardest things. First of all, to get it off the ground, I approached the RNIB. They didn't think they could help me. Talking Newspapers Association of the United Kingdom, which is still in vogue, said that it wouldn't last 6 months, and with all these sort of things. But Beryl and I, this was really before we knew you, I think. But Beryl and I, we realised that we weren't going to go under. We were going to do it. I was quite convinced that the blind people needed something what we were trying to produce. And we canvassed for money ourselves. We managed to get money from organisations. We wanted a studio, and in the end, we decided to build a studio onto the back of our house at where we were living in Lincolnshire. My son Geoffrey, and a friend came up and did all the brickwork in the building. I owe a tremendous debt to them, because they worked very, very hard. And I still think of Geoffrey, wonderful, wonderful, because unfortunately in 1989, Geoffrey was killed in a car crash. And I still look back on Geoff and think how much he did for the magazine and for me in many other ways. So it was rather sad, that, but we got the thing off the ground in the end, and when we finished it, because the Royal London Society of the Blind decided to take it over because it was getting so difficult to fund. When it eventually finished, because they said they couldn't cope with it anymore, deserted us. And I still feel to this day, I feel so unhappy about that. We had 550 subscribers. We had special postal deliveries, you know, the postman, they knew suppose 4 ago when we had to give it up.
Yes, it was a sad day for all of us when we finally had to throw the towel in. You also managed to interview some extremely famous people as well, and one of them, you could maybe slightly get one person more famous, but tell us, tell the listeners who you managed to interview and how it came about. Someone, it's strange how it happened. You just tell them about the most famous person you ever interviewed.
Yeah, well, I couldn't believe it. Just to put you in the picture, every 2 or 3 years, a magazine, a booklet is produced in this country called Door to Door. Now this book tells you how to get from place to place. It tells you all about ferries and trains and buses and what arrangements are made for the disabled on buses and trains and all the various things that you need if you want to travel from your door to where you're going. Now we were very lucky to get the contract for that, and we had to record it and produce it. I've still got high speed copying equipment here now. I can produce it, quite a lot of takes in one go if I want to. And the idea was that we should record this magazine. Beryl recorded it, and it took about 5 C90 cassettes. It was a big thing. Beryl recorded it. But at the beginning of it, and on the year that we were doing it, there was a foreword which was written by Princess Anne. Well, now, I suggested to the Department of Transport, it was called in those days, that, all right, it's wonderful, it's one thing for Princess Anne, anybody reading it, they can see the signature at the bottom, Princess Anne, all right, fair enough. But it's no good to blind people. Why couldn't we have actually Princess Anne recording the foreword? Well, I forgot about it after that. I thought, well, if they do, they're about to send an engineer to Buckingham Palace, and the engineer will record it, and I'll be given the tape. Well, blow me down, the phone rang one day. Would I be prepared to go to Buckingham Palace to record Princess Anne? I couldn't believe it, you know. It was fantastic. And, well, Princess Anne, as you all know in America, is I'm sure you do, but in case one or two people don't know, she's now the Princess Royal, and she's the Queen's only daughter. And I thought myself, my goodness me. So I went along, I played safe, I took two tape recorders, I took two microphones, I wasn't going to be let down, and it was wonderful. We waited downstairs in the palace, and then we were ushered up to her, and I'd got a guide dog with me, and I said, when we got into the actual room, she said, well, hello, what a wonderful dog, she said. And I said, is it all right to let him go? Of course, she said, let him go, take his lead off, take his harness off. So I took his harness and lead off and just let him go. And before we could get started, she was down on the floor playing with him. Anyway, she was a wonderful person. She was very, very good. She recorded it for me, and fortunately nothing went wrong with the tape recorder. It was an early digital tape recorder, and I got a very good recording. And at the end of it, I asked her if she would be prepared to do a full-length interview for our library service, and she said yes, she would be glad to do that. And she said, would it be easier for you if I came to you in Lincolnshire? Well, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I said, well, I wouldn't mind, I'd be wonderful. So she said, all right, write to me at Buckingham Palace and we'll get it arranged. So I did that. I got a letter back saying that the princess's engagements were very busy, but she was looking into it and would contact me. They eventually contacted me, gave me a date when she would come. Before she came, about a week before, I had sniffer dogs. I had a van which came down, stood outside the house. Whatever they did in it, a van, I shall never know to this day, but it came two or three times. I don't know what it was doing. And of course, when they eventually came, I had police in the house, I had policemen out in the garden, I had policemen standing in next door's garden. Next door were very uptight about it, they didn't like it, and they said I shouldn't have involved them in it. I said, well, I didn't involve you in it. I didn't know they were going to come to you. But anyway, that passed by okay. The police went through the house with a fine tooth comb. It was rather funny because actually when they arrived, I offered them a cup of tea, and they accepted it. And we did it in the microwave oven. We put things in the microwave oven, and so they knew that was safe. And the first thing they did when they started to look around the house was to open the microwave oven. I shall never forget it. Typical police, you know. Anyway, eventually, it bored. They checked our motor car and everything. And then she was due to arrive at about 12:30. It was rather funny because people... The news spread around the village is like wildfire, and we had about 100 people standing on the bank opposite the house. And I went out there with the dog for a walk, and I got a round of applause. You know, I couldn't believe, unbelievable. But these people stayed there. There was a big cheer when she came in. When she came, they all clapped, and they stayed there right to the end. Now she came. She was supposed to stay for about an hour. She had lunch with us. She was supposed to stay for an hour. She stayed for two. She did an interview in the studio, and it was hard to believe that she was a princess. I mean, she is a princess, but she was such a nice person, and we just sat there chatting away, and It was absolutely marvellous, and I got her to talk to you, didn't I? I said, well, you must talk to my other, Sue and Steve. I told her about you, and she very kindly agreed to do that. And she was rather nice because I was prompting her, and I remember saying to her, ask, because it was always a joke between Sue and I about my braille, because probably I'm one of the worst writers in the world, and I make a lot of mistakes, and poor old Sue, has she ever got round my braille? And of course Princess Anne asked her about it, and she said no comment. But it was wonderful, it really was, and that was a highlight, really. She was, I suppose, the most famous person that I'd ever interviewed, and it was a pity she didn't take over. I was going to ask her to be our patron, but unfortunately we were then under the Royal London Association for the Blind, and they got somebody else to do it, which was Prince Michael of Kent. He did it, and I think we might have been still going today if Princess Anne had been our patron. So, have I been too long? I'm sorry, Steve, but that's how it all came about.
No, that's fine, Bill. That's exactly how it came about. And it's one of the most unusual phone calls I've ever had. I know we're not talking about me, but I can't resist it. I mean, when you answer your phone and someone says, hello, this is Princess Anne, you take them back a little bit, because, of course, we live about 80 miles away from where Bill was at the time, and she did actually phone us up and have a word with us, and it's one of the most unusual phone calls I've ever had. But, as I say, it's not about me. It's about you, Bill. So, after the magazine was wound up, Bill, what was your next project? What did you do next?
Well, what I did next was to try to get work to augment my painting, the one thing or the other, by recording things for organisations. And I did quite a lot of work for London Transport, producing their tapes on the safety on the London Underground, the Docklands Light Railway, all kinds of things about travel in London, and that lasted for a fair distance, fair time. And then also I had some work from the Royal National Institute for the Blind, producing a magazine called Update, which was information for local societies all around the country for the blind. Now, we still do that. I say we still do it, but we've just been told today that that is going to fold up because, unfortunately, the people, the unit that produces it, is to be wound up, and they've been made redundant, and the magazine, which called Update, will cease as from after the April edition. So I don't know what we're going to do yet. I'm hoping to persuade the Guide Dogs for the Blind to give us some work. I hope we'll be able to do that. But if they don't, we'll manage. We'll certainly manage, Steve.
Oh, I'm sure you will. I have every confidence that you'll find something else to do. Now, just as we begin to wind up the interview now, Bill, just let's find out a little bit more about Bill Cox, the man. We've learnt a lot about your varied jobs and projects and wonderful work you've done for blind people over the years, but let's just look at your personal life just a little bit. We know you're married, and I know you've got children. Just tell the listeners about your family, about your children and your grandchildren, etc.
Yeah, well, we had five children. Christopher was the first one. He was born in 1950. He has two children who are grown up. They're grown up. I thought he'd got more. He hasn't. He's got two. I've got to keep count of all this lot. Then, of course, we had Jeffrey, who eventually had four children before he was tragically killed. Then we had Philip. Philip has three girls, a boy, and twin boys. We then Bill William, as we call him. He has three children. I think that's it. And they haven't all grown up, but there are 19 grandchildren so far, and seven great-grandchildren, with one on the way, so there will be eight. I think it'll get more than that if I live to see it, but I think it'll get more than that. And I always say to people, when we were married, on the day that we were married, we travelled overnight to Scotland, and I remember we walked down Princes Street. It was the first year of the Edinburgh Festival, and we walked down Princes Street, just Beryl and I, and I said to her some years afterwards, isn't it amazing? We walked down Princes Street, Edinburgh, just the two of us, and now look what we've done. Look what we started. Look how it's evolved, and, you know, it's fantastic, it really is, because they all come to see us. They love coming up here, and we love going down to see them, of course. But we all keep in contact with everybody. I mean, Carol, Jeffrey's wife, she's a wonderful, wonderful girl. I mean, she coped with the tragedy really so well, and well, she's coming to see us in the 2 or 3 weeks' time. We're looking forward to that very much, and as I say, they all come. So there you are. That's me as a person. I don't know, really. I like very much to listen to music still. I don't play now. I did get up to grade 7, but I couldn't carry on with it. I thought I might be able to do an LRAM over the years, but I realised suddenly that if I've got to study music each night, I'm not going to grow up with my family. And I decided to put the children first in the end, and got a job as a social worker. I managed to fulfil that ambition. But now I listen to music. I suppose I must have somewhere nearly 1,000 CDs here, which I do very much enjoy. And so does Beryl. And we both do all kinds of things. She's very much involved in all kinds of work. She belongs to charities, and I'm just an ordinary bloke, Steve. Nothing much to think about, really. I'm just an ordinary bloke.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you are. Just an ordinary bloke. Oh, yeah. Well, you've proved to us for the last hour that you're not just an ordinary bloke, and you're a great guy. Just finally, I do know the answer to this one, of course, like I've known the answer to most of the questions I've asked you, to be quite honest. But how did you become involved with for the people, and are you enjoying being a member?
That has been a milestone. For the people has been a milestone in my life. I think I've got two or three milestones. One is Beryl, another one is you and Sue, and I think I must add For the People to it. I never realised that there was such an organisation, and if I may say to Jennifer, I don't know whether she's listening or not, but I think it's a wonderful thing that she started. I know you're very much involved with it, but what gets me with For the People is the friendliness of everyone. I mean, I come on here in muddles and goodness knows what else, and everybody wants to help you. Nobody gets uptight about it all, and and not only that, I think it's a great thing. You can meet people literally all around the world, and you know, when I think of Uncle G and Kevin and his names are too many to really mention, but I hope it goes on for many, many years, long after I've gone. I hope it's still going, and that it will go on from strength to strength. I really do. It's a great organisation. I mean, when Country Mile says stick around, you'll have a marvellous time where friendship abounds, and it is true. Friendship really does abound here, and you told me about it, and you showed me how to get it, and I was very quickly put into the system, and long may I be here. I shall behave myself, because I don't want to be thrown off it.
Okay, well, on behalf of everybody, Bill, can I thank you very much indeed for sharing your life with us. It's been a very, very interesting life you've led, and genuinely it's been a great pleasure knowing you, and I hope we remain good friends for many, many years to come, and it's been a real, real pleasure talking to you. I don't know if anyone wants to ask you any questions about your very varied life, but if they do so, are you willing to take a few questions from the floor?
Oh, absolutely, yes, I'd love to. No, no problem there. No problem at all.
Okay, over to the peeps. Have you got any questions for our very, very good friend, Mr. Bill Cox?
Wonderful interview, Steve and Bill, and wonderful to have you with us, Bill. I hope you can hear me through my bronchitis. I was wondering what particular genre of music are your favorites?
Hello, Jennifer, and thank you very much for allowing me to come on to For the People. It's wonderful. I always say that the three greatest composers, I feel, are Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. I can't separate them. I feel it's impossible to separate them. But having said that, boy, do I like Tchaikovsky and Brahms, and very much, I suppose, in the classical vein, but I also like big band stuff. I enjoy that, and I enjoy some jazz. I like the Quintet of the Hot Club of France, Stefan Grappelli, but in the main, I think the classical music is a major part of my life, Jennifer, and to me, I couldn't live without Beethoven, Brahms and Mozart. I certainly couldn't live without Brahms and Tchaikovsky, and there's so many of them. I like some of the modern music, but things like composers like Stockhausen and Cage, and I don't understand it. I don't profess to understand it, and I always think to myself, if I can't sing it, then I don't really like it.
Very good point, Bill. And thank you again for the interview today.
Well, it's a great pleasure, a great honour to be asked. I'm sorry, I do wish you well. I wish you well, and I hope that you soon get better.
Yeah, hiya, Bill. Nice interview. Thanks very much indeed. I really enjoyed that, both you and Steve. Nice. Good job, and really nice to hear about all that, Bill. Do you find that then, Bill, that your classical influence would have been from being at school, that your music lessons and things have all been based on classical music? Because I remember a lot of ours music lessons were classical, and sit and listen to classical music, and I suppose in that sort of vein that your school in those days would have done the same thing. Is that right, Bill?
I think there's a lot in what you say. The actual music lessons, which I had at school, I think put the foundations down, but I really began to get absolutely into the classical music was during the war, when I joined a music lovers club, which was run by the local Baptist church. In those days, I belonged to the Baptist church. I don't now, but I belonged to the Baptist church in those days, and we had a music lovers club, and that gave me an insight into it certainly introduced me to Beethoven and William Walton and one or two others, and it really developed from there. You know, in the old one had the 78 records, and then the LPs came along, and now the CDs, and of course it's much easier now, the CDs are so brilliant. But yes, I think you're right, Steve. Chris, the foundation went down at school, but I like to feel that I built on that myself just a few years after leaving school.
And I suppose that actually having those concerts to go to as well, with you being near London, a lot of those would have, well, they're all classicals, aren't they? The festivals, they're brilliant to listen to. But what about people like Vaughan Williams and Liszt, Delius and Liszt? Did you get any sort of feedback from those, Bill? Did they not impress you?
Some of Vaughan Williams certainly does impress me, very much so. There's a piece by Vaughan Williams called The Lark Ascending, which I couldn't live without. I think it's wonderful. His London Symphony is very good. Some of his stuff I find difficult. Delius? Yeah, well, I've got a fellow feeling towards Delius because unfortunately he lost his sight, didn't he? And Eric Fenby from Yorkshire went over and helped him to produce some music, and he was Delius's amanuensis, and he did a lot for Delius, and I've got quite a lot of Delius in the library here. Liszt amazes me. I do not understand some of his transcriptions. We think you need three hands to play them, Beryl and I. We know you don't, but it seems incredible, really, me, how he could. Some of these transcriptions that he produced, and there is a complete list. There is a complete set being raised at the moment by Naxos. That's a music label. And they're trying to put onto disc all the piano music of Liszt. Now, it's already been done by another label called Hyperion, and it's 97 CDs. So you just see what wonderful, what marvellous stuff he turned out, Liszt. Yeah, I like Liszt very much indeed. But of course, I still come back to it, Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart. Wonderful stuff.
Okay, anyone else? Question for Bill?
Bill, hi, I'm Steve. I love classical music too. How about for people who don't like classical, maybe haven't been exposed to it, what do you say to them is great about classical music?
It's a difficult one, that, isn't it? Because a lot of people say, I can't stand classical music and all the rest of it, and What I try to do, if I try to introduce people to perhaps simple classical music, something simple, and see how one goes on from there. You see, I was thinking about Bach. You wouldn't introduce people in the early stages to Bach. Bach doesn't get hold of you by the hand. Bach, you either go with him or you don't. Similarly, Beethoven and probably Mozart's a little bit easier. Tchaikovsky, if you can introduce people to Tchaikovsky, try to introduce somebody to the Sleeping Beauty or the Swan Lake or the Nutcracker. Wonderful stuff, wonderful music. And of course, he takes you by the hand and If you can get them going on that. But I've had lots of failures with people. I've not always been able to convince people of the joys of classical music. But those that I have often said to me, I'm glad I met you, because now I'm listening to music which I never thought I'd listen to.
Bill, this is Becky. I just wanted to thank you for the wonderful interview today. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You certainly made a wonderful life for yourself, and I think your own motivation and determination did it for you.
Well, thank you very much, Becky. I hope that's right. I haven't stopped. I'm still now working very much for the Guide Dogs for the Blind Association. I sit on the National Consultative Committee, which is an organisation for guide dog owners. And we are very much now in contact with the top echelons, as it were, of the Guide Dogs for the Blind Association. And I'm a local representative for East Anglia, where I live. I'm also helping to arrange what we call an independent mobility project for blind people. And I travel quite a bit still. I've got to go to four different places in April, and it's all very exciting. As I say, I shall be an octogenarian on the 28th of August, but I don't intend to give up. I mean, I feel, Becky, that if you sit down and just think to yourself, oh well, I can't do anything else, and sooner or later it's going to happen. Well, you know it's going to happen, but I'm not going to wait for it. It can overtake me if it wants to. but I'm still going to go and do things. So long as I can stand on 2 feet, and long as I can hold a guide dog harness handle, Becky, I'm still about.
And I don't doubt that for 1 second.
I don't know, Billy. You're just a spring chicken, as we say over here. Franklin's in the room with us, and he's also a musician, and he's got 4 years on you, buddy.
Oh, well, there's hope for me, Jennifer. There's still hope for me. And the 19 grandchildren keep me going. I don't know about the great-grandchildren. That's a little bit of a different project, but there's a lot going on all round about, and I still feel very much involved with it all. And long may it continue.
And you're truly an inspiration, Bill.
Well, it's very nice you to say so, Steve. I don't consider myself very great. I mean, I've only done in life what... If I've given, and I say this in all sincerity, if I've given some encouragement to visually handicapped people, then what I've done wouldn't have been in vain. I hope that I have helped them. And I think in many instances, I had it said to me when I was a social worker, I got some wonderful letters and comments from clients, and they all said the same thing, that they felt that when I came to visit them, they got something out of the visit. And of course, that was what I was trained to do, and I hope that I just feel very humble. I feel rather humble for some of the things which I've been said, which have been said to me, and it's all been so well. It's been worthwhile. At times it's been very difficult. It's been awfully hard. You go through your bad times and your good times. You know, particularly with the loss of Jeff, that was a terrible thing to get over. But you don't get over it. But you've got to learn. You've got to pick yourself up, and you've got to say, well, I've got to go on with life. He wouldn't want me to moan and mope about, and one surely doesn't. And, that's the way of it. But I don't know. It's very nice of you to say I'm an inspiration. if you say it too many times, I'll believe it. I think it's wonderful. Thank you very much, Steve.
Yeah, Bill. Yeah, Radio Ham as well, aren't you, Bill? When did you do that? When did you start doing that as well?
1952. That's right. I'm on my 51st year now. Yeah, 1952. Always wanted to do that. I used to listen on 40 metres before the war. We had a set which could get 40 metres, and I used to listen to you. I said one day I'd love to do that. Of course, the war came, you couldn't do it. And then from 1948... 49, 50, I was engaged in other things, and it wasn't really until 52 I rang up City and Guilds one day, and they said, oh yes, you can do the, if you can do the examination. Somebody came and gave me some lessons. They were very helpful, and they sent a man down to my home, and he interviewed me, brought the paper along, and I had to answer the questions. There was a terrible, difficult one with arithmetic in it, and Beryl was sitting with me at the time. And he said, "Well, if you can do, if your wife can help, can do the arithmetic, I don't mind her telling you how to go ahead." God dear, 10^6 over root pi LC. I shall never forget it. But we got through that. That was okay, and it's been wonderful because I've had all these years on the air, and I've met many people all around the world. I've spoken to them, and I've met quite a lot of people in person. And it's a great hobby, and I'm still very much involved in that because we have a amateur radio club at Lowestoft, and I happen to be its chairman. I think I'm its chairman because nobody else wants it, but I've been chairman now for 6 years, and still very much involved with that. And totally enjoy it. And I still go on the air from time to time, though I'll tell you a little secret. Don't tell anybody, Chris. I seem to be more on for the people lately than on the air.
Do you know, I'm sitting here with egg on my face. I didn't even mention the amateur radio. That's the problem when you know someone as well as I know you. It completely slipped my mind, but apologies, folks. Yes, indeed, he is a ham.
G3 India Whiskey Charlie.
I was just thinking how much more awkward it must have been taking the license in those days, sort of 50 years ago.
Yes, because you had to describe everything in those days. It was they were quite helpful, the examiners, but they made sure that you knew something about it. I mean, but nowadays, of course, you get about 30 questions and you tick a box. Which you think is the right answer. It's all very different today, but in those days, I mean, we had to describe a circuit. We had to say what a frequency, how you got to a frequency, and describe megacycles and all that kind of thing. It was a lot harder. And of course, you weren't allowed to use speech on the air for a year. And you had to pass an examination in Morse code, that would be 12 words a minute, and I went to a post office in up in the east end of London, Stepney, and took this examination, and I managed to get through it okay. And in those days there was somebody, because it was run by a post office, it isn't now, it's run by a radio communications agency, but in those days it was run by the post office. And they had somebody who could read Braille, and I had to send a Braille log up at the end of the first year, and they came back to me and said, well, we feel you've done rather well, but we think you should have done more than you sent us. And I wrote back to them and said, well, can you tell me how you can bring up a family of three boys and spend every day doing hundreds of calls on the radio? And I got a letter back saying thank you for your letter. I have pleasure in enclosing a radio license.
Bill, I don't believe I've ever talked to you. This is Carl from Pittsburgh, PA, United States of America. You seem to have led a rich and good life. Take care.